everybody. I'm Sheila. I'm an alcoholic.
Thank you.
And thank you, Dean, for asking me to speak. And I think my friend Marcella probably had a hand in that. So not to give away your anonymity or anything. But, you know, it's always an honor and a privilege to do service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm very grateful to be here tonight. And welcome to the newcomers. We're glad you're here. And, you know, at my first meeting, when they said that to me, I'm like, I don't believe that. You know, they can't possibly be glad that I'm here. You know, they don't know me. And I was used to hearing, you can leave now and don't ever come back. And mostly it wasn't that nice that it was said to me, but we are glad you're here. And, you know, I have to start out by saying that my sobriety date is April 7th, 2007, and Jaywalkers is my home group. Because the last time I spoke, for some reason or another, I didn't say it, you know, and they're two very important things to me. You know, I'm grateful to have a sobriety date and to be standing here tonight, and I love my home group, the Jaywalkers, and I do a lot of service in with the Jaywalkers, and actually I missed my meeting tonight with my home group to be here, and that's okay. And I'm going to do the best I can tonight to show you in a general way or tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And, you know, I just started out in, I grew up in a small town in southeast Missouri. It was on the earthquake fault line, and it was just really, really small, and everybody knew everybody else's business. And even as a kid, you know, I had a lot of isms. I didn't grow up in an alcoholic family. As a matter of fact, my parents have never taken a drink to this day, and my grandparents or anybody in my family that I know of. But I had those isms as a kid. You know, things that I wanted, I just went for them. And I knew what the consequences were going to be because my mother could really, really swing a switch. But it didn't matter. If it was something that I wanted, I went after it. But my solution to the problem of getting switched was to put gasoline on the tree and burn it down, catch it on fire, because that was the way that I thought. And it was kind of hard growing up in the country because there was not a whole lot to do. But we made do. And I had a lot of friends, and we just really, it was good. And so when I got a little bit older, about 12, 13, we moved into a small town. And I met a lot of friends then that had a lot of things. And, you know, they had nice clothes and different things like that. And, you know, that's what I wanted, too. I always wanted something, you know, that you had. And we were not... You know, our family didn't have much money at all. And so I just went ahead and went to work when I was 13 in a little Dairy Queen so that I could buy things that I wanted so that I could keep up with you. And that was when, at 13, I picked up my first drink. And I wanted to be like everybody else. And it's kind of strange. You know, I always kind of felt like I fit when I was younger. It seems like when I got older is when I felt like I didn't fit. But when I was younger and when I was a kid, you know, I was athletic, I was kind of smart, you know, I just kind of fit in. And, you know, things were good. But all my friends and all the people that I started hanging out with when I was about 13 were drinking. So I had my first drink, and it was Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill Wine. And it cost 50 cents, so that tells you it's been a few years ago. And, you know, I liked the way it made me feel. You know, we had a lot of fun. We laughed and joked. And you know, at that point, it wasn't that I just really wanted to do it again right away. So my drinking throughout my life has been progressive. So we just started kind of, you know, sneaking around and drinking on the weekends because, you know, my parents, especially with them not being drinkers, they could smell alcohol a mile away. So I couldn't get away with much at all. So I spent a lot of time spending time with friends of mine, you know, spending the night at their house and all because I couldn't, you know, sneak in and get away with, you know, being intoxicated. So I drank through high school and went to college. And there I had no rules, no regulations, no curfews, no nothing. So it was just on. It was, you know, quarter beer night, 50-cent tequila night. I lived on the 11th floor of the dormitory, and it just seemed like every tequila night that elevator was broken. And, you know, I crawled up 11 flights of stairs, but that's okay. You know, the next Tuesday night, it was the very same thing. That was kind of a pattern in my life, just repeating same things over and over again. I think that they call that insanity. But I knew about that at a very young age. And, you know, in college, I met a lot of people and partied a lot. And, you know, I really gravitated to people that drank like I did. And I really started hanging around with a lot of guys because I didn't have time for, you know, women who just couldn't hold their liquor and then I had to, you know, take them home or give them a ride or they were sick or whatever. I didn't have time for that. But, you know, we would go across the river in Illinois because the drinking age was 19. And after a while, you know, the bars would close about 2, something like that. And then we found another bar that stayed open until 5 in the morning. And, you know, we would just drink until that late. And I remember walking out and the sun just hit me in the face. And I'd look over at, you know, a couple of people that were still there left drinking with me and say, What happened to everybody? Where did everybody go? And I remember he turned around to me and said, you know, Sheila, most people just don't drink like we do. I'm like, oh, okay. And, you know, there were signs all along the way, but I just, you know, just refused to see them. I just wanted to do what I wanted to do. And I made it through college and actually, you know, graduated and did okay. But like I said, this was a very progressive disease for me. You know, when I really needed to buckle down and study, or I needed to go to work, I needed to know what, you know, do what I needed to do, I did it. And I had made a promise to myself, if you're going to drink on a night that you have to go to work the next day, or you've got to get up and go to class, then you have to get up and go to class, or you have to get up and go to work. And I kept that promise for a long time. As bad as I felt, I would still make myself do it. And I got out of college and married a good alcoholic. And we started our life together right back in that small little town that I couldn't wait to leave. And we went back there and moved out into the country. And I started working and we just partied all the time. We drank all the time. I mean, you know, I would meet him in a little bar across the street, you know, from where he worked in the afternoon. And sometimes we'd drink for a little while and go home, and sometimes we would close the bar down. It was just continuous. But I have to tell you a little story about this friend of mine in Missouri. And she never had too much money, and you know, she couldn't really have a babysitter, so she had a 4-year-old. And he was like my little bartender. So we would drink a lot at her house, and Paul would go to the refrigerator and get me a beer. And he was always, you know, sitting there by me, and he would look and he'd say, you need a beer, don't you? And he would go to the refrigerator and get me a beer. And my nickname at that time was Pearl. So he and his mom were going down Interstate 4 one day, or not I-4, but I-55, and there was a big Budweiser truck. And he said, Mom, what's that say? And she said, well, Paul, it says Budweiser, King of Beers. And he said, well, then Miss Pearl, she must be the Queen of Beers. You know, this is a 4-year-old that knew how I drank, you know. And I'm friends this day with this kid. He's like 30-something years old right now, and he's stationed in Afghanistan. And I keep up with him on Facebook. And he knows I'm sober, and he hit me up not too long ago on my Facebook page, and he goes, I'm really proud of you, but no matter what, you're still my queen of beers. But, you know, it was just life in a really small town. And after my ex-husband got his second or third DUI, they told him, they said, you know, it might be a good idea if you just, you know, move out of town, or move out of state would be better. And so we decided he would join the Navy. And I'm like, well, that'd be a great life. You know, that's a, you know, that's a great life for somebody who really likes to party and drink. So we just, he went to on to boot camp, and I stayed back, you know, for a while. And, you know, a lot of crazy things happened. I came to one morning and went out, and my car was really close to the front step. And the whole side was just bashed in. Well, I went in and called the police and told them that somebody stole my car and wrecked it. And, you know, they came, you know, and they talked to me. And I knew the guy. I went to high school with him. And he goes, well, let me try to find out what happened, and I'll get back with you. And he came back about an hour later, and this car had hit a house, had hit the side of a house and tore up a bunch of shrubs and all. And that was about 3 miles from my house. So somehow or another, I managed to do this, not know it, not recall any of it, and still make it home and park right by my front step. But they couldn't prove it. You know, they didn't know, especially since I'd reported that somebody stole it and drove it. They couldn't report it. So things like that, I was always kind of on the edge of getting in a lot of trouble, but nothing really bad happened yet. And, you know, I still, in the back of my mind, a little bit had a conscience, because we were out drinking one night. It was about probably 3 in the morning, and we were totally out of alcohol. We had none left whatsoever. And so we decided that we would break into this bar. And we did, and we knocked the lock off, and we went in, and, you know, we took a lot of beer and bottles and things like that, and we were getting ready to leave. And I mean, I had money in my purse, and I'm like, man, this is wrong, but you know, I can't help it because the bar is closed at 3 in the morning. I need something to drink. So I took the money in my purse and I just threw it on the bar and walked out. And to me, that was justified for what we did. And I just did a lot of things like that in my life, and just I raised 2 children in this disease. And the first one, she traveled around with us while Steve was still in the Navy. And she was a great little Navy brat. And she was the one that would go and you know, get the beer off the table and, you know, drink some of it and all. And you know, she just, some of you know her. And she's in this program now. And she has 3 years of sobriety. And I'll get to her in a minute. But, you know, as a mother in this disease, I was present. I was always there. I didn't really, you know, go out too much. When I did, I always made sure that I had a babysitter and I had things squared away and taken care of. But, you know, when I was there, I was present, but I wasn't present. You know, my kids were there. I cooked for them. I did what, you know, I took care of them the best that I could. But, you know, I wasn't always there for them. And after a while, we moved to Orlando. And my ex-husband, well, he was still my husband at the time, and he was stationed in Jacksonville. So I just all met a whole lot of new friends, and I really started partying a lot. I have to back up just a minute, I'm sorry, to Pensacola. And he went out to sea for 6 months. And a crazy thing happened. He got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I said, that's wonderful. I'm so happy for you. You know, with a drink in my hand, you know, and I was very happy for him, but to me, I didn't have a problem. And out of respect for him, I kind of, you know, curve things a little bit and try to be respectful and try to, you know, cut down as much as I could. And then as soon as he went out to sea for 6 months, you know, I would start in with my friends and we would just party. And he'd come home for a couple of months. I'd slow down. He'd go back out to sea. Same thing. All this cycle over and over again. So anyway, I got a good job opportunity, so I moved the kids to here to Orlando. And he was stationed in Jacksonville, so it kind of worked. He kind of came on the weekends, and everything went okay for a while. And then he got stationed back in Pensacola. And I said, no, I'm not moving anymore. I'm tired of moving. I'm not doing it. My kids, they were happy. I had a career, a good job, and I chose not to move. So that was pretty much the end of an 18-year marriage. And, you know, he was pretty tired of making that drive from Jacksonville, and by the time he got home, you know, I was already, you know, pretty wasted by, you know, 7, 8 o'clock at night. And, you know, that just got old for him. And so, like I said, we got a divorce. And then I met somebody else, and he was I met another alcoholic. And this time, he was a violent alcoholic. And, you know, it was just fire and fuel to the fire. Because two alcoholics drinking together and, you know, with strong personalities, it just didn't work. And, you know, it was physical violence. It was domestic violence. There was police were called. It was a very dark time, very dark time. And, you know, I don't know why I couldn't walk away. I don't know. I think that at this time in my life, I felt like I didn't deserve any better, that this was just the best it was going to get. That, you know, I deserved to have a man that mistreated me. You know, it was just a very uncomfortable time, very. And, of course, my kids were just, you know, they were wrecked. And they hadn't grown up in this, and it was very hard. It was very hard for both of them. Well, my oldest went away to college. She went as far as she could get on a softball scholarship to University of West Georgia to play softball. And I just had the youngest one at home and finally, you know, got rid of this man. And then I started partying with a bunch of people in the neighborhood, and they would come all the time, and we would just party, you know, from morning to evening. And I was still working and, you know, had a good job. And but things were starting to kind of slip. You know, I would go to work. I didn't feel very well. I was trying to think of excuses, why I could go home. I just always had a doctor's appointment, a dentist's appointment. I just had a million excuses, and I started calling in, something I said I would never do. And I also really prided myself that, well, I don't drink on the job. But, you know, when you drink till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and then, you know, you had to be at work at 7 or 8, you're usually still, you know, a little intoxicated. So that rule went out the window, too. And I had the same boss for several years, and he was great, a good man. And he pulled me aside one day, you know, and he goes, Sheila, I don't know what's going on with you. I really don't. He said, but, you know, something's gotta give. You know, your absentee rate is up. You know, you're calling in. You know, your work is not being productive. Some of your coworkers are saying that you've become unapproachable. And, you know, that's not good when, you know, you need to work with a team and you're the person that kind of holds it together, but you're unapproachable. So, you know, I went home, I took that to heart, and I drank at him all weekend long. Because none of that was my fault, none of it, you know, he was just picking on me. And so life just went on, and things just kept getting worse and worse. And I didn't know what to do. I really didn't know what to do because, you know, you get to that point to where it says in the big book, you try this and you try that, you try different things. And it just seemed like nothing was working, nothing. And I mean, I almost got to the point to where I was going to give up. And I was just going to drink. And that was just it. And I was just never going to try again because I just felt like nothing was ever going to work and that I was never going to get sober. And I moved. Did a geographical. I said, maybe that will help. I thought, if I get away from these neighbors that come over to my house all the time and party with me, maybe it'll be better. So we moved. I kept the same job, I've been kind of an overachiever in my life, too, so when the chips were kind of down and I was kind of in a little trouble, I would work really hard. I would go in early, I would stay late as I could, and I would work on the weekends, and I would just, you know, do the best that I could, because I had to hang on to that job because I had to take care of my kids, and I had to have money to drink, so I had to hang on to that job. And so I tried really hard. And, you know, at this point, I would make plans. I would never go through with them. If I told you I was going to meet you somewhere, I didn't show up. I gave you no explanation. I just didn't show up. So at this point, I really didn't have any friends. They'd all pretty much said, you know, she's not dependable. She's not going to do what she said she was going to do. And they stopped calling. They stopped coming around. And at this time, it was around Halloween. And I got a call from my daughter, the one that was going to school in West Georgia. And one of the girls on the softball team, a 21-year-old with a wonderful, bright future, never been in trouble at all, had a designated driver that night. And she started out partying at my daughter's apartment, and they brought her home, and she was supposed to stay there, but they gave her keys, and she got in the car, and she drove, and she struck a pedestrian who died 2 days later. And my daughter called me at home and told me that, and she was very shook up, and it shook me up, too. And from that point on, it really rattled me enough to stop drinking and driving. Because I had driven, I couldn't even tell you, thousands of times. You know, I had your kids in the car with me, you know, wherever I drove. But at least the parents did figure out that I couldn't be the pickup mom anymore. I had to be the drop-off mom. Because I could usually stay sober, fairly sober, 7 o'clock, to drop kids off somewhere at the movies or somewhere that they were going. But I definitely could not be the pickup mom. But, you know, I did. I drove around, you know, with kids in the car and things like that. And, but that kind of scared me enough to stop drinking and driving. And then she came home soon after that because things got really, you know, bad in Georgia. And she didn't want to stay there any longer with all of this happening, so she came home. And so all of a sudden, this house that I moved into just became the craziest party house ever. And me with no friends, my friends became these 16, 17, 18-year-old kids. And I'm not proud of the fact that I allowed them to drink and party in my house. And that was just more drama and chaos and police and, you know, just different things like that. And things just kept getting worse and worse. And I thought, one day I just had it, and I just got this big piece of cardboard, and I wrote on it, no visitors allowed, and I put it on the front door, and I thought, this will do it. It didn't. It didn't do anything. You know, they laughed at it, and, you know, just came on in. But, you know, at that point, I was drinking in my room, in my house, alone, with nobody else. You know, every once in a while, I'd get somebody to pick up the phone, you know, when I'd call. And, you know, this family that really has, they've been a wonderful family. I grew up in a great home. Well, you know, even they stopped picking up the phone because I would call them sometimes all hours of the night, not making any sense whatsoever. And I didn't go home for 4 years because I didn't want them to see what kind of shape I was in. And it just, it went down to just a few phone calls here and there, but I was ashamed to go home. And I was also a little bit afraid that if they did see the shape that I was in, that they would take my kids. And so I stayed away. I stayed 1,000 miles away for 4 years. But, you know, that relationship today is good. Matter of fact, me and both the girls went home last year, and we had a wonderful, wonderful visit. It was great. We stopped in Graceland, you know, went to see Elvis's home and all of that, and then spent some time with my parents and my sisters, and it was great. I went to an AA meeting there in this small town, and I got there, and I kept saying, man, this looks familiar. You know, the building that we were having the AA meeting in. And finally I turned around to one of the guys and I'm like, this used to be a bar? He goes, yeah, it was the Oak Room. I'm like, oh, man. I said, I know exactly. I've been in here many a time. So, you know, it just, I was home, you know. And it was, I have to tell you about a bar in Tequila. I mean, a bar in Pensacola, too. There's a sign that I'm pretty sure that if you ever go to Pensacola, don't go in a bar. But, I mean, there is a bar. There's a sign that hangs there saying, no tequila for Sheila. And that's a whole other story, too, but we don't have time for that. And, you know, but this loneliness that I felt and this craziness and all this drama and all was just, it was crazy. And I got a phone call about 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was my oldest daughter. And she said, Mom, I'm being pulled over and I'm drunk. And at that time, I hit my knees for the first time in a long, long time. I mean, I grew up with God in my life and I went to church with my grandparents. But as I got more and more into my alcoholism, I turned my back on God, and I thought, he's given up on me, and you know, there's just no turning back now. But I got on my knees that night, and I prayed, and I asked God to help my daughter. And I made a bargain, and I don't recommend this, but I bargained with God that night, and I said, if you will help her, I will make a change to my life. She called me back about 20, 30 minutes later, and she said, he's going to let me go. The cop's going to let me go if I can get a ride home. And, of course, I was drunk. So at the time that she needed me the most, I couldn't help her. I couldn't go get her. So I said, ask him if you can take a taxi. And he said yes. And so taxi brought her home. And I knew I had to keep that promise. I knew that I did. And I said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do this. And, you know, I'm an alcoholic, and I've got that crazy thinking going on. So I said, there's one more thing I got to do before I can, you know, get sober. You know that violent alcoholic I was talking about? Well, in my crazy mind, everything was his fault. Everything. All my drinking, all my problems, everything was. So I thought that if I just eliminated him out of my life, that I could have a clean slate and that I wouldn't have any charges against me, nothing would happen to me because he was so mean to me, and I could just go about my merry way. So I loaded a 357, and I loaded myself pretty good, and I got in the car and I started driving to Osceola County. And along the way, I stopped and I was out of ice, so I had to make another drink. And, you know, I popped the trunk of my car and these two guys walked by and they're like, wow, you got a party in that trunk. I'm like, yeah, pretty much. And they said, well, would you like to, you know, go and have a drink with us? And I'm like, no, I got things to do. I can't. But anyway, I ended up, you know, going with them and drinking, and I woke up and came to about, I don't know, 6 or 7 o'clock that morning, and alone in an abandoned house. No recollection of anything, in a total blackout. I'm like, oh, my goodness. You know, I did not know what had happened. I didn't know if I had killed someone. I didn't know where I was, nothing. I had my keys in my pocket, and I found my car. It had my purse in it, and it had the gun in it. I made a phone call to make sure this man was still alive, and I went home, and I took a shower, and I told my kids, clear your schedule, because I'm going to an AA meeting tomorrow night. Never been to one, didn't know anything about it, and I said, I'll call when I get to work, because I'm sure that they probably don't open until 8 in the morning. So I'll call AA at 8 o'clock and find out, you know, where there's a meeting. And sure enough, I called the next morning. Very nice gentleman told me where there was a meeting that night, and I went. I had one of my daughters on one side, one on the other. I went in, and people were smiling. They were happy to see me. They shook my hand. They gave me a little pamphlet that said, keep coming back, and just don't drink one day at a time. And at that time, I was like, my gosh, this is crazy. I can't do that. But I listened, and for the first time in a long time, I felt a glimmer of hope. And I felt like maybe, just maybe, I could do this if I listened to what these people said, because they were sober. I wasn't, but something was happening with them. So I said, I'm going to try this. And I went for 11 days. Every single day I went. But I went late and I left early. And I got drunk after 11 days. And that last drunk was terrible. I didn't even enjoy it at all. And I'm like, you know what? Maybe these people are onto something. Maybe they do know what to do. Because I sure can't do it. I went back. And I got a sponsor that night, and she was tricky. She said, I tell you what, when you come tomorrow night, come early. And I want you to meet some people. I want you to tell them your name, shake their hands, learn their name. So I was a greeter before I even knew what a greeter was. I was doing service in Alcoholics Anonymous at 12 days sober and didn't even know it. And, you know, she must have known that she had to get me busy. She got me through the steps, you know, just like that. She got me into service. I chaired my first meeting when I was 90 days sober. You know, I just took off in Alcoholics Anonymous. And every day I felt better. Every day, you know, I could just, the fog was starting to lift and things were starting to clear out. You know, and my kids, you know, at first they were not happy because it was like no alcohol in the house, no illegal substances in the house, none of this. And they were like, whoa, you know, they weren't very happy at all. And but they saw a change. You know, they saw me be a little calmer, you know, just a little bit more tolerant of people. I was going to work, you know, I wasn't complaining as much. And, you know, they saw these changes take place in me. And I believe that other people see these changes way before you do. I mean, I felt better, but I didn't really see, you know, that I was getting better. But people saw it. My boss saw it. You know, the people that I worked with, they were really happy because they used to have this running joke that don't talk to Sheila till noon because she's hungover, so don't even be trying to talk to her. So they were very happy, and, you know, work was much more productive. And 14 months after I got sober, my oldest daughter came into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, she went to a, I was driving her back and forth to the bar. I was dropping her off and picking her up because I didn't want her to get a DUI or a wreck or get in trouble. Now, I got in a lot of trouble from my home group and my sponsor for doing this, and I don't recommend it, but, you know, as a mother, I just did it. I just did. But, you know, after a while, she said, you know, she said there was a, it was a long-timers panel. And she said, I just don't believe that people can stay sober for 30 years. I've never heard of such. And I'm like, well, me either, really, but I'm going to go, and I'm going to listen to what they had to say. You know, maybe I can learn something. And she said, well, I think I just might want to go. I'm like, all right. She said, will you drop me off at the bar afterward? I'm like, yeah, I sure will. She never made it to the bar. That night, you know, as soon as she told me, she goes, I think I might want to try this. Here I'm going around trying to find a sponsor for her, you know, and I'm like, I got to stay out of this as much as I can, but I do want somebody to talk to her tonight. And I found somebody to talk to her. And they picked her up the next night and took her to a meeting, and she picked up a white chip, and now she has a little over 3 years of sobriety. It's wonderful. And, you know, I wish I could sit here and tell you how wonderful everything's been, and most for the most part it has been. But my youngest daughter, that's my pain. And it's getting better, it is. But I was at the assembly, the area assembly in Gainesville, and I got a phone call about 2 o'clock in the morning, and my youngest daughter tried to commit suicide. And I wanted to just shake my fist at God. I just wanted to say, you know, God, why are you doing this to me? I'm trying to do the best that I can and do the right thing, and now you've done this to me. But, you know, I didn't. I thanked God that she was alive and that I was going to make it back in time to see her and spend some more time with her. And that was huge for this alcoholic, because most times my first thought, get a drink, numb the pain, and be done with it. And, you know, we went through a long time of institutions, and, you know, she was a lot of drug use, a lot of alcohol, and I'd have to Baker act her, and it was, you know, I did this all sober. I didn't have to pick up a drink over it, but it was very hard. It was, you know, just to see her and my sponsor say, Sheila, you are powerless. You are powerless over this. You have got to let it go. You pray for, be there for, you are not in control. And you know what? I learned a huge lesson over that, a huge lesson. And finally, the last time that she got out of Lakeside, she was going to see her psychologist. And when she came home, she said, guess what he said? I'm like, I don't know, honey. What did he say? He said, maybe I ought to go to NA. Really? She went. She's been going ever since. She just celebrated a year in June. You know, that is just the miracle of this program. I couldn't have done that. I couldn't have done it at all. And when she was in the hospital, and when, you know, she's been in and out at Lakeside, you guys just held me. You just wouldn't let go. You know, you just walked me over to Dunkin' Donuts and bought me a cup of coffee. You prayed for me. You texted me. You called me. You hugged me. You showed up. And, I mean, that is just the power of this program. It's just, it makes me so grateful, because I'm not alone anymore. I'm not, you know. I'm not that woman sitting in her room drinking by herself with no friends and calling people that didn't answer the phone. You know, I'm not that person anymore. I can hold my head up high and you know that I can walk through anything. And, you know, my sponsor tells me, you know, stay in the now. I'm bad about that. She has to tell me that a lot, because I tend to try to project and get into the future and all this, and it's hard, but I'm really working on it. I'm working on it because she's a wise woman. She has 25 years of sobriety in this program, and there's really not much that she hasn't walked through. And I love her for being willing to pass that to me and to pass her experience, strength, and hope to me. And I do the best that I can to try to do that with my sponsees today, too. I'm just grateful that I haven't had even the thought of picking up a drink in 4 years. it's wonderful how this program just does that to you. If you just do, you know, take a few simple suggestions. You know, I'm a firm believer in Alcoholics Anonymous, in good sponsorship, the 12 steps, and service. I love service. I want to give back what was so freely given to me. And it's been a gift, a real gift. And I do the best I can to do that. And meetings, I love meetings. You know, I'm grateful that, I mean, you know, we grew up as a family in addiction and in alcoholism. And now we're a family in recovery together. And, you know, it's amazing. It's amazing. You know, this one's leaving to go to this meeting. This one's going to go chair this one. And this one's going to do this. We all do service, in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Allison and her program, too. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And I'd like to close with something in this book. And it just kind of sums up my sobriety. And it's called Enjoying Recovery. What a journey. This process of growth and change takes us along an ever-changing road. Sometimes the way is hard and craggy. Sometimes we climb mountains. Sometimes we slide down the other side on a toboggan. Sometimes we rest. Sometimes we grope through the darkness. Sometimes we're blinded by sunlight. At times, many may walk with us on the road. Sometimes we feel nearly alone. Ever-changing, always interesting, always leading someplace better, someplace good. What a journey. I'm Sheila. I'm an alcoholic, and I always will be. Thank you all for listening.